We're on. Hello, everybody. Welcome to the second episode of Underground Antics. I'm Shane, and on today's agenda, there's a few things that we've got to discuss today, but we're going to start off with meditation, because here's the thing. I've been thinking a lot about meditation and what it is and what this whole mindful movement is in general, and you know, why it's taken such a grip on people and why some people are like anti-meditation, which seems kind of odd, but whatever, we'll get into it. But there's a whole lot of things that are really cool about it. And, one of the fundamental bits about meditation is that, well, what it is it's essentially attention training. So what that means is that just like you can work out a muscle, you can work out your ability to focus on the present moment and not be distracted by thoughts slash feelings of either the past or of the future. And that's the whole concept of being present, right? It's a synonym. Present being like in the moment, you're doing what's happening now, and you're not suffering, any anxiety or feelings of depression or things like that, because you're focused on the immediate present. And this is a thing that's been around, you know, probably at least 3,000 or 4,000 years, dating back like in the Indian culture, and then, well, Buddhist is more recent, and that's the one that's really taken up really well, and it seems to resonate deeply with people. But it's like, here's the thing about being present, is that the moment, or rather the state of being present has lots of different ways of characterizing it. Like, people talk about it in different ways. Some people call it, you know, a flow state. Some people call it in the zone. But it's that feeling of being like really immersed in whatever it is that you're doing. And some of the more like extreme examples of this are any activity that you do that's highly dangerous, where you have to focus on exactly what you're doing right now, because if you don't, you might die. And that's why, well, that's partly why people like to get involved in extreme sports, is because it forces you to, you know, be present. And that's a feeling that everyone resonates with and that they, you know, they seek after. And so the theory is with like regular mindfulness practice, you can experience that sort of feeling like all the time, which is crazy, because that would be cool. I mean, I definitely haven't gotten that far yet. But I mean, like, there's obviously something to it, because they've been doing it successfully for like thousands of years. And if it was bullshit, then they would have stopped it at some point. Now, maybe it's not for everyone, and that's fair. You know, we're super complicated creatures, and everyone's like super different based on all sorts of different factors. But like, you know, some examples are like, I saw that movie of the, I can't remember what it's called, of the dude who like free climbed a mountain or like a steep hill kind of thing, you know, with no ropes attached. And it was, you know, it went like a million whatever in the air. And part of that is that you have to be like so focused on every particular step or grip that you take, because if you don't, you might fall and die, right? So that's like one example of the extreme sports. Or like maybe another one is speeding, like speed racing, because you're on the edge of, you know, life and death, essentially, where any moment could be catastrophic, but it's not, because you're focused and you're in the zone. Now, some people can like get into that zone with like long distance exercise, like long distance cardio, you know, those people who do those mad ultra marathons, which are like 200 miles straight. There's something, you know, really powerful about their minds, when you know, every part of your body is just not working or not wanting to continue, but your mind is like powerful enough that they can overcome that and just push through and power and, you know, run for like 60 hours, run slash walk for like 60 hours. It doesn't matter. I mean, it's unbelievable how they do that. And so, you know, there's also a lot of different kinds of meditations that come up. Like sometimes people meditate where they want to have no thought. And so they want to have a clear mind, which is usually the traditional understanding of like what meditation is. It's like to get to quieten down your mind or to like get rid of thoughts or things like that. And that's definitely, you know, a way that people do practice. But one of the other cool practices that people do is to meditate on like an idea, right? Or a concept. And that it could be directly related to you or just a, you know, theoretical concept in general. Most people, you know, probably aren't as inclined to meditate on like subject matter or like philosophical ideas, you know, like I am, and that's cool. And they'd rather focus on a particular area of their life where they can improve themselves. And, you know, I do that too. And there's obviously other people out there who are more like me or not like me, and it works for everyone. But the point is that you're bringing up these thoughts into your conscious awareness and being aware of that you're doing that, right? So it's not like where you're unconscious but still awake, where thoughts are just sort of happening and you're following through with them like on automatic mode, you know? I mean, it's crazy like to think about like where thoughts come from. I mean, you don't know where thoughts come from. No one knows. Like, they just sort of happen. They appear in your consciousness. I mean, obviously they came from you. I'm not saying they came from elsewhere, but like, which part of you? Can you pin it down to like the specific neurons or sets of neurons or whatever? That's extremely difficult. And even so, that doesn't really explain anything. That doesn't explain why it feels like a thought. All that explains is like, oh, this is the, you know, chemical formula for it. It's like trying to explain what cold is. You know, cold is a sensation that requires like conscious perception of it, right? There's a way it feels to it. And there's a way it feels to pretty much every experience that we have. And, you know, there's like debate over whether you can include that in like a scientific body of knowledge, you know? Like, is it possible to explain what it looks like to see the color red? And it's really difficult. I think they call that the hard problem of consciousness, if anyone's interested. But it's a really cool idea, because, well, the point that I want to make about it is, when you're in your mind or whatever, the theater of your imagination or things like that, thoughts and, you know, fantasies, which is like just daydreaming or imagination or dreaming, like all that I'm sort of lumping together, they sort of just like appear to your consciousness, and then you also get an emotional or a body sensation that goes with it. Right, sometimes it's stronger than other times. Sometimes it's overwhelming. You know, some people have like overwhelming thoughts and they end up having like panic attacks and things like that. And so they're definitely not, you know, able to like control those thoughts. I mean, you can learn, like people learn, and that's why there's treatment and things like that. But just to give an example, but you also might have just like a random thought that doesn't have such an emotional attachment to it, like I should go buy some cheese later or something like that. You know, there's no real like body sensation to it. But if you have a thought about, you know, maybe like an upcoming assignment or something like that, or a project that's due or a deadline, and then you get that like anxiety, that sensation, that's, you know, the accompanying response. And the weird thing about it is that it feels like it's you who is having those thoughts and feelings, because it is you, but you can also separate yourself from it. You can choose to ignore it, so to speak. And that's really weird, because that means like, well, yeah, which part of you is ignoring what? That's super confusing, but I mean, that's the, you know, foundation on which people can learn that not all of their thoughts have to be taken seriously, and so they can learn to differentiate between thoughts that serve them and thoughts that don't. in order to, you know, make sure that they like live properly. But yeah, so it's really weird. I was recently reading this book on like the latest, you know, understandings of emotion and things like that. I think it's called How Emotions Are Made. It's a really cool book, and it like detail. I can't remember who the author is. I'm sorry. It's a really cool book, and in it, you know, the author explains how emotions come to be from like a neuroscience perspective. And I'll tell you, her name is Lisa Feldman Barrett. All right. It's called The Secret Life of the Brain. So in it, she really describes how emotions serve our functioning, right? Like there's obviously a reason that we have emotions, and they're extremely powerful. And most of what maturity involves is just like learning to deal and manage your own emotions and not let them overcome you. You know, and as you get older with more experience, you get better at it, obviously. And the more you do it, the more likely you are to be able to have a better control over it next time. And you can sort of like keep building that strength. And then because you're aging or whatever, you have more different experiences in different like zones. And so, you know, you're always like integrating new information about how to be and what the best way of living your life is. And so anyway, regarding the emotions, one of the interesting things that she was saying was that people generally think that, you know, you can describe an emotion with like a set of adjectives. And to some extent you can. But there's no what they call emotional fingerprint that exists the same in everyone, so that everyone feels emotions the same way. So what I'm trying to say is that like people feel anger differently. They report different symptoms to feelings of like the same supposed anger in, you know, similar contexts or environments. And this is like a worldwide phenomenon. Like they've run tests all over the world, and what they concluded was that you can't tell just about someone's like psychophysiological symptoms, or more, not symptoms, I guess, not the right word, like expressions, exactly what emotion that person's feeling, because it's not so straightforward, because there's a whole lot of things that go into experiencing an emotion, because it's your context and it's your history and it's your like operating system and the way you view the world makes a big difference on how you perceive events in that world. And so people from different circumstances will view the same event differently. Obviously, that's not, you know, news, but and even if it upsets them, let's say in the same way, the feeling of being upset will feel different. And one of the good examples of like where this is more obvious to people in like everyday life is like grieving, right? Like when people die, people mourn differently. And it's you know, it becomes more obvious the more time you spend with a person, and so who is grieving, and there's lots of different ways, and there's no right or wrong way to mourn someone. But the point is, it's like some people can, you know, continue with their lives sooner. Some people feel like they need to wait longer. Some people like whatever, you know, but it feels different for everyone. Which is really cool, because it means that, you know, they're like extremely complicated phenomenon that we're just starting to really understand about it. And one of the other things that she was talking about was that, and actually, what's his name? Jordan Peterson touched on this as well. It's like you have two main systems of positive emotion and negative emotion. And these systems are activated. The positive one is activated when you're moving towards a goal and something happens that brings you closer towards that goal. So you perceive that event as helping you to attain your goal. And it can be a long-term or a short-term goal. Doesn't I mean, it matters, but it's the same idea. And then, you know, for negative emotion, it's more like feelings that come up when something prevents you from achieving your goal, or like creates a, you know, momentary barrier, or maybe even a permanent barrier. Like sometimes you can have a goal and it something happens and it just no more goal. And that's where people experience negative emotions. And so, you know, one of the interesting things about that is like, well, people who don't have goals, and it doesn't have to be like a formal list or whatever it is, but people who don't like have hopes and like goals for the future, like they don't really experience positive emotion because their systems aren't telling them that they're on the right path. So they're just sort of stuck in this like nowhere land where they just get a bunch of negative emotion and or nothing. I mean, you know, there can be some positive emotion from like hedonistic pleasures and things like that, but most of the time it's not. And so that's just an interesting, yeah, that's one of the things that I thought was super cool. And the point is, it's like emotions are super complicated to understand. It's really exciting as a field, like, to learn about it. And, like, the research is just going to continue, and it's going to be epic. On the note of the brain, a lot of people, you know, in today's discussions talk about cybernetics and being able to, like, connect with technology or integrate the human body with technology, which is sort of like people expected to almost definitely be on the horizon in the near future, like Elon Musk's Neuralink and things like that, like really crazy stuff. I mean, I've no idea how long that's going to take. I imagine longer than people think, because, you know, our understanding of consciousness is very basic, but I suppose you don't have to have a full understanding of it for it to be effective, you know, particularly in curing degenerative like brain disorders. Like that's one of the main functions, I think, of Neuralink, is to be able to substitute for different parts of your brain, different parts of a person's brain who is, you know, suffering from this or that or whatever. But we're actually pretty much We're very close to that already, like with our phones. You know, our phones just aren't integrated into us, but we're super attached to it. And in fact, we use it as like a part of our brain. So for example, you know, no one remembers contact information anymore. Like in the old days, you know, like I'm old, but not so long ago, you had to remember people's phone numbers if you wanted to phone them, and or addresses, and people had like address books and things like that. But nevertheless, it was like a lot more information that you had to store inside your head was happening, whereas today you just know that your phone has that information, and so you don't need to actually be thinking about whether or not you have someone's information, and you don't have to remember it, and because you're like, no, my phone has got that info, so and I can access it immediately whenever I want. It's a little bit slower than memory, obviously, but because you have to like pull it out and do stuff, but it's essentially, you know, a part of you. And particularly, you know, you could even extend that into pictures and videos as substitute memories, in a sense, because I mean, it's crazy, people don't put their phones down these days, you know. They're just like trying to like capture like every moment, and there's lots of reasons for that, but the point is, like, you know, you rely on your phone being with you forever, essentially, as in some version. Like obviously you'll upgrade and update, but it's not as foreign as people think. And then, you know, like the Apple Watch or the Google Watch or any of the smart watches, that's even one step closer, because that's like attached to you now. Like actually attached to you, it's just not inside of you. And I imagine it won't be long before that advances quite significantly, and then they'll start probably, you know, like doing like surgical things. I mean, they do that already with like pacemakers and, you know, like deep brain stimulation things and whatever. Like, it's already starting and it's really awesome. But I lost my train of thought again. What was I talking about? Oh, Apple Watches. So one of the things that, you know, we'll only be able to learn in the future and look back on as like, you know, whoops, is the dependence that people get. Well, not, maybe dependence is the wrong word, but your watch consumes, your watch or your phone, it doesn't matter, it consumes a part of your brain's attention all the time because it's waiting for a notification, essentially. It's waiting for that little buzz that tells you something happened and you get a little hit of dopamine. And even if there's nothing actually happening and you're not in a conversation with someone or expecting anything, a part of you is concentrating on that specific thing because you want to know when something comes up, right? And so you become like super, you know, like watchy. And, you know, I've seen people who will be like in the middle of a conversation. They'll be like in the middle of a sentence. They'll be saying something, you know, they'll be like, I don't know, what will they be saying? Like, look at this weather today. How whatever it is, you know, last week it raining and I think it's raining. And if you're just listening, what I did was I looked at my watch as if I had a notification, but I didn't because it's not a digital watch. But it's weird because it interrupts people's conversations and they don't know that they're doing it. Like, it's such a reflexive response now, you know, a little buzz and you just go whap and you just need a look just to see. Like, you aren't even intending to deal with it now. You know, you might be in a meeting and you've been like, all right, no phone calls and whatever, but you still want to know what, in some sense, what the message said that you have to deal with later. And you don't have to do it that way, you know, like you don't have to wear that watch, and some people are better at it than others, and you can like turn off the vibration and you can make smart adjustments to yourself and your routine to make sure that, you know, you're not overwhelmed by your watch, essentially. But yeah, but I mean, like, we're already part cyborg. It's just not as dramatic as, you know, the movies make it seem. Well, not yet, at least. But, you know, things will come out where you'll be able to, like, have vision stuff, like the cool eyes and things like that. So you'll be able to, like, see the internet stuff happening, like, as you, part of your consciousness. So it'll be part of your vision, right? You can even imagine it as, like, you know how you see on TV those like virtual reality or augmented reality video games where people set up like in their houses and they have the stuff on and the cameras, like the glasses, and they basically have like the game is like happening in their personal space with objects that they have plus like computer generated shit on top of it. And so it's like a hybrid world. And I think that will become pretty like developed in the next, you know, well, in the next few years for sure. But, you know, one of the weird things is just going back to like a previous point about how your phone is a part of you. Like, we typically tend to think of ourselves as like, you know, just this body, mind, if you want to make that distinction, which you shouldn't, but nevertheless, it's like you're this thing that's like one piece, and you can't be, like, things can't be outside of you but also part of you. And that kind of gets complicated because sometimes people value things external to their body more than they value like their body, you know. Like, just think about something, you know, like if a parent like loves a child, like, hopefully they'd rather like give up a leg or an arm than give up the child, because that child has such an, in their perspective, a more important role in their life than their arm or their leg, which is true. Like, that's not a, obviously it's not a criticism, but so, you know, you can have things that are part of you that are actually in your environment. You just don't think about it that way. But it particularly comes up, you know, when you get more into like routines and things like that, where your whole world is, you know, shaped by it. And so it's, you know, it's not clear exactly what part of you is you and what's not part of you. Because if you have your hand, like it's easy to say like, okay, this is my hand, and then if I chop it off, right, then it's sort of my hand, but not really anymore. It's now like a former part of my body, but because it's not attached to me and it's not living, it's not my hand. It's just a hand that I used to have. And so, you know, do you lose part of yourself if you lose a hand or a leg or something like that? And yes, you do. Like, you know, we typically think that everything cognitive happens like inside the head, but it doesn't. It's actually embodied throughout. And so you get weird shit, like people who have organ transplants having developed like certain habits or ideas or things like that from the organ donors that they never knew or even met, but they all of a sudden, like, you know, developed a taste for something or have a preference or something changes and they don't know where it came from, but it's like from that organ. Now, that's extremely complicated and I have no fucking idea what I'm talking about, how that works, but I know that that's happened. That's well documented. And so, you know, and when you lose an arm or a leg, like people have these like phantom pain things where they feel the pain in their arm, but they don't have an arm, but they feel the pain. And, you know, I imagine that's something that you can't really explain properly unless you experience it. I've never experienced it myself, but I'm sure there's a lot of people who have experienced that, like, phantom pain phenomenon. And so, yeah, you know, like, how much of you do you have? Can you cut off before there's no more of you left? You know, in philosophy and things like that, they talk about the ship of Theseus story, which is basically that, suppose you have a boat made out of wood, right? So it's like an old school pirate boat. I think pirates made their boats out of wood. I have no idea. Could have been anything. I don't know much about them. So let's say you have a boat that's made out of wood, right? And you're sailing. Now, one plank goes funny, and so you take it out and you replace it with a new one and you chuck that old plank in the water. And let's say, you know, every day you got to replace a different plank of wood because, you know, maybe the wood degenerates quite quickly in the story, right? Let's suppose. So you got to go through like all of them. So you're going through like a full round. And so every day, you know, you rip out a plank and put in a brand new one and you chuck that old plank in the water. And that's relevant for later on in the story, the plank in the water bit. But what happens when you've replaced all the planks? Is it the same ship? Sort of. Sort of not. It is in the sense of, you know, you're calling it the same ship and it has the same function as the previous ship. Like that hasn't changed. That sort of transisted through time is its, you know, function and what it does more than what it is. And so it's a difficult question. There's no exact answer to it. I mean, people have answers. They argue one way or another, but it's not conclusive. And then the second part of that is like, suppose someone was in a boat behind you and was picking up all of the planks that you threw away and used that whole set of planks to create a new ship that sort of is now in existence. Now, is that new ship, which is made of the old ship wood, that's obviously different from the first one because it's not the same one, but it's exactly the same in every other respect because it's made up of exactly the same bits that made up the first one, but it's not the same as the first one. And yeah, I mean, it's not easy to know like how to answer that question. And to me, the answer lies in a functional explanation, which means that if the function and like objective has stayed the same over time, then it's identified as the same thing over time. You know, I mean, if I'm not mistaken, like all the cells in your body will change every 7 or 10 years or something like that, where you'll have a completely different set of like matter that makes you up as you did 10 years ago, but it doesn't feel like that. Or maybe it does, but because it feels like you're old now or whatever, but it doesn't feel like you've been different matter. And, you know, your memory certainly goes across time. Like, you might forget some stuff, but most people remember lots of things from, you know, well beyond 10 years ago. And so, how does that happen if all the cells change? And how are you the same you? And, well, maybe you're not. I don't know. But if you look at it from a more, like, integrated function perspective, it's like, well, you still serve the same whatever purpose you were doing. You still serve that same thing as a single unit. And so it makes more sense that, like, that would be the case, that you still feel the same and identify it as the same person. You know, if you look at a childhood picture of yourself, like, is that still you? Sort of. There's some continuation. It's hard to know exactly what it is, but it feels like it. And so... yeah, I mean, you know, I don't really have an answer to the question, but it's more like, okay, what's the other example? So, I can't remember who made this argument, and I apologize to that person who's long dead, but nevertheless, suppose you have, you know, the statue of David, which is that famous Greek statue of David, and, you know, suppose technology has advanced super well, so that we can remove one atom at a time from the statue, right? So you can obviously remove a lot before you even notice a difference. But at what point do you no longer have a statue because there's not enough matter? And how do you determine what that point is? Because it can't be arbitrary. So if you take the whole half, top half off, you know, well, is that still the statue of David? I mean... it's half of it, but, you know, what if you just took, like, the head off, or just maybe an ear? I don't even know if the statue has ears, but let's say it's an ear, like, take it off. It's like, what if you just take one atom off? Then is that still the same statue? And, I mean, it has to be in the way we talk about it, because atoms, you know, move, and it's not stable across time. So there's something that keeps it together. But yeah, whoever came up with that's, you know, long time past now. But yeah, like, you know, I think that was a good discussion about different things. Oh, here's another one, right? When do mountains start off as a mountain? You know what I mean? Like, where do you say, like, oh, this is the mountain now, and this is the ground, and then this is the mountain? No. You can't. It's nonsense. Unless you be like 1 degree, but you can't even do that, because then you'll have like a million little mountain bumps just in the ground. And so how do you know when a mountain's a mountain? I don't know. Everyone seems to know. If you point out and you're like, hey, check that mountain out, everyone knows what you're talking about. No one's going to be like, well, what's the mountain? You know, well, which part of that's the mountain? Like, no, like, we know what's happening, but... technically, we don't know what's happening, and I'm not sure what to make of that. But you know, mountains are really cool, and yeah, that's like a fun fact for the day. You can, you know, be like, yeah, that was fun. When are mountains mountains? Anyway, I was gonna get into, you know, why trees have feelings. But I think I'm going to leave that for the next one. Also, if you are 99 pounds and you eat a pound of cheese, are you 1% cheese? That's a good question. I know it's a stupid, goofy question. I was just joking. But yeah, thank you for tuning into the second episode. if you haven't subscribed, you know, hit the subscribe button wherever. There'll be links in the description to the Patreon and to everything else like that. And I'm looking forward to continuing this series. And yeah, I hope you all have a great rest of your day. Take care. We'll be right back.